Again, to start out the introductions, I would ask that Darren White Jr., who is coming to read a letter to you from Susanna Martinez.
Yes, as they mentioned, my name is Darren White Jr. Most of you might know my dad. He was a former Bernalillo County Sheriff. He wanted to be here this evening, but he had a prior speaking engagement, so I am filling in for him. So on behalf of Susanna Martinez, the Doñana County District Attorney and Republican gubernatorial candidate, I'd like to read this short letter. I sincerely apologize for being unable to attend tonight's forum. I hope to have the opportunity in the near future to share my vision of reform and accountability for New Mexico, in addition to answering your questions in person. Unfortunately, my father was diagnosed with cancer yesterday and has been admitted to a hospital in El Paso for emergency surgery and treatment. He suffers from Alzheimer's, and I must make decisions regarding his care and treatment. While I enjoyed participating in Thursday's debate in Clovis, I was looking forward to tonight's forum, but the needs of my family come first, and I'm by my father's side at the hospital. Thank you for your understanding, and I expect to be back on the campaign trail soon. Sincerely, Susanna Martinez.
So next, Pete Domenici, Jr.
Thank you. Since I'm the first speaker, I want to echo Godspeed for Susanna and her family. I also want to say go Lobos. And then I want to introduce myself. And the way I want to introduce myself is by telling you what I believe. And I have a series of beliefs. I set these out in my various literature and my website, but I want to make sure everyone that's here today and made the effort to come is clear on those. I believe in limited government to protect unalienable rights. I believe in cutting government spending to what is based on need, not greed. I believe in upholding the 10th Amendment of the Bill of Rights, which protects important powers and reserves them to the states. I believe in defending the unborn who cannot protect themselves. I believe in lowering taxes so that we can keep more of the money we earn. I believe in expanding private sector jobs, not government jobs. I believe in restoring the death penalty to deter and punish those who murder our law enforcement officers. I believe in granting driver's licenses only to legal residents.
And as you can see, we have a little oral reminder also. Next, Alan Way.
I'm Alan Way. The first thing I'd like to say to this crowd is you may remember an old country song called I Was Country Before Country Was Cool. Well, I was at the first Tea Party, and I was Tea Party before it was cool. I'm a business executive, run a business for 31 years, retired Marine, reserve officer, service in three wars, and the U.S. expedition into Somalia. I'm running for office for the first time. I'm running for office for the last time, exclusive of re-election if I'm elected your governor. Why am I running? I'm running to change the way we do business in Santa Fe and get government off our backs. I'm pro-Second Amendment. I'm a strong believer in the 10th Amendment. I'm pro-life, I'm pro-family, I oppose any move to change the definition of what marriage is between a man and a woman. I believe in the death penalty. I believe in the death penalty for egregious crimes going beyond just law enforcement officers. And I think the conditions in New Mexico are reflective of a recent quote by the President of the American Taxpayers Union: when you subsidize poverty and failure, you get more of the same. I'm elected your next governor, intend to go to Santa Fe and change things. Thank you.
I'm going to try something a little bit different. My name is Doug Turner. I've tried to meet most of you. I don't think I've had the chance. I've never run for office before. And I think I'm here really for the same reasons all of you are here, because I've really had enough of what's gone on in this state for the last 8 years, the way we've squandered our resources. We have bankrupted our state. We are giving our children the worst education that any state provides to children in the country. And I think that the right people to get involved in this are people who work for a living, people who have families. I'm a small business person. I've got two young children, a three-year-old and a five-month-old. And so I think that those of us who work for a living really are the best people to lead a state that is in such dire straits. So I'm here today, not someone who's doing this because I need a new job or a new career, not someone who's doing this because I need a pension, but someone who's doing this because I think we live on this earth for a very short time. And if we can leave this earth in a better place than when we arrived, we've had a full life. And so that's why I'm in it, and hopefully over the next hour and a half, you'll hear what I believe. Thank you for coming.
I'm Janet Arnold Jones. I'm an Air Force grad, a resident of New Mexico since 1963, a graduate of the old Albuquerque High School and UNM. My husband, John Jones, is a retired Navy commander. He has been my arm candy for 35 years. I'm going to keep him. We have a son, Robert, and a daughter, Mary. I am a Navy wife, mom, entrepreneur, business manager, soccer coach, and community volunteer. I am a four-term member of the New Mexico House of Representatives. I serve on the Tax Committee as well as the Voters Committee. As a member of your unpaid citizen legislature, I have served by being prepared, reading the legislation, asking tough questions, and demanding that the information be available and accessible. When our Constitution was trampled and tax bills were log rolled, I stood against the Speaker of the House in defense of our rules, of our laws, and our Constitution. I took a webcam to the legislature because I knew the abuse would not stop unless you helped out, and you have come through with flying colors. As your governor, I will conduct business in the open. I will convince the legislature to do the same. I will concentrate on fiscal responsibility and doing the people's business. As governor, I will lead the state to a revitalized economy, an effective service-oriented government, free of pay-to-play corruption, an educational system that's among the top in the nation, and a revitalized economy. Thank you.
Two more quick announcements and we'll get to the questions. I have it on a reliable source. Final score, BYU 81, Lobos 83. So the other piece of paper you were given tonight is your scorecard. You can take notes as you want, but at the end of the evening, we are going to ask you to rate the candidates for the candidates on how they delivered their message, on their depth of knowledge, and their believability. You'll see those there on your cards. So make your notes, but a little later on, we'll ask you to circle a number there, 1 to 10. So we're going to get on with the questions, which is what everybody I'm sure came here for. And again, with the campaigns, we randomized again so that we have every candidate getting an equal chance. And so our first question goes first to Pete Domenici, and then we'll go to Alan Way, Doug Turner, and then to Janice Arnold-Jones. How will you, as governor, see and exercise the proper distribution of power between the state and the federal government, especially under the 10th Amendment, in situations like the current health insurance reform bill?
The 10th Amendment, for people in the audience, I'm sure most of you are aware of it, It was a very specific section in the Bill of Rights that was created after the Constitution was entered. And it was done specifically to make it clear that the federal government had limited rights, and rights that were not granted specifically to the federal government are reserved to the states or to the people. And the Tenth Amendment has been gradually eroded over many decades and actually several centuries, but it is having a resurgence in various areas, including many areas where the federal government tries to tell states directly what to do, and they are being rebuffed by courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. The federal government is being told, you cannot tell the state what to do. In the area of health insurance, there will be, and this really depends on what comes out of the health insurance morass that we're in right now at a federal level, and we may end up with, who knows, it just looks like a stalemate to me, but if something like the Democrat proposal makes it through there, or something along those lines makes it through Congress, which I have serious doubts of, but if it does, states will have the option to challenge portions of that that require states to take activities that have not been specifically delegated to the federal government. States can do that individually or collectively, and with groups like you, states are starting to act collectively to enforce the Tenth Amendment. But I would do it individually as your governor or collectively with other states. It's typically done by filing a lawsuit to say that the federal action is illegal, unenforceable, and does not apply to New Mexico.
What I find fascinating about the Tenth Amendment is its origins. For those of you who don't know its origins, you'll find them in the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were 85 published essays by John Jay, who happened to be our first Supreme Court Justice, James Madison, who was the President, and Alexander Hamilton, who you remember was the Secretary of the Treasury, and was killed in a duel by Aaron Burr. That aside, in paper number 9, written by Alexander Hamilton, you can clearly see the origins of the Tenth Amendment. And I'll quote just a few of the lines in this interesting paper. This government is composed of small republics. It enjoys the internal happiness of each. The extent, modification, and objects of the federal authority are mere matters of discretion. It would still be, in fact and in theory, an association of states or a confederacy, and leaves in their possession certain exclusive and very important portions of a sovereign power. It's readily apparent that our founding fathers intended that the states be sovereign. Let me assure you that if I'm your governor, we will not allow unelected bureaucrats or bureaucracy to trample on us. Those of you who know me will know that I'll stand up for this state's rights. And in regards to the current impasse on health care, clearly we're not going to know what's going to take place until it takes place. And I can tell you, right now, I hope nothing takes place because it is a mess. And if they attempt to pass a bill through the use of reconciliation, we'll find that we'll go to court.
Mr. Turner.
I'm going to answer the question. First of all, I'm sure so many of you are familiar with the Tenth Amendment Pledge. I've actually signed it. You can check it out. The signature page is on my website at turnerforgovernor.com. What can a governor do to say no to Washington? That's really what the question is. And I think if we go back to 1994 and look at the sweep of Republicans who were elected in this country, I think we had 34 Republican governors after that election. And I'm confident that after this election, we will also have a majority of Republican governors. If you have enough Republican governors in this country, you can take power back from Washington. We did it in 1994 when governors went to Bill Clinton and said, no, know, and we had a governor here who did that. We had governors across this country who did that. We have not had a governor who's been prepared to say no. We've had a governor right now who's just prepared to just take the money and give it to his friends. But the reality is that the federal government holds us hostage in so many areas, and healthcare is one of them. I mean, right now, we get a 3-to-1 match in our Medicaid dollars, and it's very difficult for our legislature to say no. But I am convinced that in this time, and I think healthcare, the healthcare debate, in many respects, brought us all together, that if we stick together and we don't let up, we elect more governors in this country and more members of Congress and more senators when we get to that point, and more legislators who are prepared to say no to Washington, we can say no to whatever health care bill comes down and is rammed down our throat and is damaging to our economy. So stay active, elect more people who are willing to say no.
It's probably more basic than that. The governor has to say no. And let me tell you how this happens, because you need to know where the no's come in. So let's start with the Medicare and Medicaid dollars. We do have a 3-to-1 match. And I assure you, sitting in the legislature, it is very tempting to say, oh, my goodness, we can't do that because we'll lose our 3-to-1 match. I assure you that we have been entirely held hostage, and we have been kept down because of that match. But it's not the only one. In the current budget, $70 million of FMAP money is hanging out there like a little carrot. And we don't even know if it's going to come in. And I assure you on Monday, that amount of money will be in the budget that they're going to cram down our throats. You say no. You say no because I know that if I say no to any of these things, if I say no, we are not going to just allow anybody to go across our borders. I'm going to do something about it. That the federal government can send the troops after me. Revolution is a good thing. Governors need to do that.
A quick reminder, the volunteers are at the aisle, so if you want to get a question, we'll collect them up so that when we get through with these first four, we'll be able to go on with yours. The next question will go first to Alan Way, then to Mrs. Arnold Jones, then to Pete Domenici, and then to Doug Turner. What amendment to the New Mexico Constitution would you champion as governor, and why or why not?
I'd make it mandatory that you show a photo identification when you vote. I don't think I need 2 minutes to tell you why. But I'll just add that if we don't, if somebody else's hand's in your pocket and it's voter fraud, then that's why we need it. And if you have to have it to cash a check, you ought to be able to have, or even more hypocrisy, if you have to have a photo ID to get to see the governor for 5 minutes, you ought to be able to have a photo ID to vote. And that would be a
say that yielding back time just means we'll get to ask that many more questions, so that's good. Mrs. Arnold Jones.
Well, Alan took my favorite one. So let me give you another one, because many people don't know it's there. A number of years ago, we passed a constitutional amendment that allows the state to take your taxpayer money and give it to developers for low-income housing. And, you know, I believe that stifles not only free enterprise, but the reality is we are not providing quality, low-income housing. And you didn't even know it was in your Constitution, did you?
Yeah.
And so we skirt the anti-donation clause because we put that particular amendment in our Constitution. And while I'm at it, I brought my Constitution. And one of the things that just aggravates me about printing this, you think this is right, don't you? And I get up on the House floor and I argue the election law and come to find out the federal government trumped on our Constitution, and it doesn't count.
New Mexicans to use a constitutional amendment to restore the death penalty. The movement to eliminate it that took place recently, I think, was not popular with the general public. I think it was a political coup of sorts with various consortiums that were able to get that through. But by allowing the people to vote on that through a constitutional amendment, I think it will be clear that the public's goal of protecting law enforcement officers and the public's value of that service and the deterrence and the punishment for that action will come back to the Constitution. And it is not that difficult to amend the Constitution. People say, oh, you have to amend the Constitution. Yes, you do, and yes, we can. And that's one that we can do and should begin the process and accomplish that very quickly.
I'm with Alan on the driver's license. You know, what's crazy about New Mexico, I think we're one of six states in the country that issues driver's licenses to people who are not supposed to be in this country. And so it's a little bit crazy that we are doing that, and yet we don't require our own citizens to show their ID when they go and vote. So I'm with Alan, and I think we need to require people to show their ID when they vote.
Our third question will go first to Mr. Turner and Mr. Domenici, Mrs. Arnold Jones, and then to Alan Wood. Explain how your fiscal policy will be applied to the state's budget problems with specific reference to taxation versus services like the Rail Runner and the size of government, state employees and state programs.
Good question. I have long been on record that I think we need to slash the size of our state government. I spent an entire day standing outside the state legislature on the first day of the session protesting in the snow against new taxes, and I have a newfound respect for protesters after that day. let me just say that in the last 7 years, our state government has become incredibly bloated and incredibly wasteful. We have new state agencies. We have 5,000 new state employees, which cost taxpayers $250 million a year. You add that over 8 years, that's $10 billion, far more than our budget deficit now. We went from 167 political appointees under our previous governor to almost 800 at one point under this governor, costing us another $35 million a year. So if you want to treat state government like a business, which I think it should be, and as a small businessman, I think I can do that, you have to get rid of all these people. You have to do it immediately, and one of the first things I would do as soon as I'm elected is get rid of every political appointee in this state immediately. You know, I'm sure all of us know someone, if not individually, who've been affected by this recession, and we'd all certainly like to go out and buy a new car and a new plasma TV, but we can't. And if we all have to tighten our belts, I'm a firm believer that government can also tighten its belt without cutting services. I think it's a false argument when we hear from Democratic legislators that to balance our budget, we are going to cut services. I completely disagree with that. We've managed to do it before. It's going to be painful to balance it, but so what? We can handle it, but we have to do it now.
The question was taxation, and then specifically referenced the Rail Runner and services and the size of government. The Rail Runner has come up over and over again at the conventions that we've all attended around the state. There is a huge problem and concern with the Rail Runner, and it exemplifies other projects, and I don't know if they would qualify as quote services, but they are projects that are unnecessary projects. They are heavily subsidized, and they will have to remain heavily subsidized unless we privatize them or do something else to salvage them or substantially modify them. So the Rail Runner, as an example, should be removed from the backs of taxpayers and detail there is demand to support it, or if we have to change the way we operate it and operate only certain sections of it or certain parts of it, we need to do that. We can't afford the rail runner. We never could afford it, but now we know we can't afford it. So that's the long issue on the railroad. On the other issues, we need to reduce employment, state employees by attrition, by terminating appointees. We need to keep the service high by keeping quality employees and moving them, putting them in jobs that they can, that meet their qualifications, that demand them, that force them to use their full efforts and full quality. And that's how we will keep services, by lowering the amount of payroll. We will also have to cut capital projects or phase them over time. We're going to have to do all three. It's going to have to come in services or in payroll and capital projects and these long-term projects that we're going to have to wait for, wait till we can afford them.
This is our report.
Well, fiscal policy. Let me tell you what. Beginning with the rail runner, there was no plan. There was no cost-benefit analysis. And anybody who has half a brain could sit down and figure out that this was going to cost us a lot of money and that we were not going to have the resources to pay for it. Of course, in 2003, we were promised that we would not need to go to the regional areas and ask for more taxes. And, of course, you all passed those just last year. And did you know that as we increased those taxes, our projections were wrong again? And so we don't have enough money to cover the operating expenses, which they told you was $24 million, but it's not. It's $50. That's what we're dealing with. And so when you have a governor who comes in who is much more interested in making a name than serving the citizens and doesn't want to actually present their plan, you've got a problem. So let's talk fiscal policy. All right, we have taxes that are meant to provide enough revenue to provide those services that cannot be provided any other way to the citizens of New Mexico. Today, right now, we have revenue potential of about $4.6 billion. We have a budget coming on Monday of $5.3 billion. They're going to raise your taxes. It makes me so mad I can hardly see straight. And on top of that, when I look at that tax policy, it is convoluted, it is complicated, and it is designed to carve out certain groups of people to have benefits while others carry the burden. Taxes should be low, broad, fair, equitable, and easy to administer. They are not. You should not spend, as a business person, more than 1% of your gross revenue in an entire month for all of your taxes in a whole year. And I assure you, I'm going to bet every single one of my colleagues sitting here spends way more than that. It is not that complicated. When it comes to services, let me tell you the other ugly secret that will not happen here. FTEs will have real bodies.
Mr. Wood.
Thank you. Well, it isn't that complicated. But they try to make it complicated in China Bank. You know, as a business guy, I've run the business for 30 years. I never spent more money than I made. A novel idea. I can tell you from the governor, we're not going to spend any more money. It's coming in the door. I had that discussion on the radio this morning. I had to walk a lady through it. It's kind of, and I described the household budget. You know, if you're only getting $30,000 a year, you're only going to spend $30,000 a year. Based on the income, we're going to be in a declining income period for the next couple of years till we can turn the economy around, and that can be done. But it's like the sink rate of an airplane. You can pull the throttle back, but you're still going to be sinking for a little bit till the aerodynamics come into play and lift you. And so we're going to be faced with that for the next couple of years. And what it's going to take some smart business practices. I simply divide up need to have and nice to have. And I noted the other night on Channel 13 that Senator Bill Payne has stolen my slogan here, need to have, nice to have. But if I can influence government, I think that's a good thing. Assuming they stick to the need to have and only fund what's left over for the nice to have, which is essentially what we do. Essential government services, 100%. Nice to have, guess what's left over. It means that every legislator who loves to take home pork doesn't get to take home a senior citizen center or the new paint job or the new kitchen for the senior citizen. I'm sorry, guys, you're not going to get it this year. You know, if instead of the museum being open, museum in New Mexico being open 7 days a week, maybe it's open only 5 days a week. There are common sense solutions to get us down to where we're only spending the money that's coming in. And oh, by the way, fund the really important stuff. That's still doable. And I can tell you, in terms, I ran out of time. I didn't get to the railroader, but I'll get to it later.
Our fourth question starts with Ms. Arnold Jones, and then to Doug Turner, Alan Wade, and then Pete Miniger. Can you explain your philosophy on individual rights, property, business, water, when they interact with the authority of the state government?
That's a great question. And it is the one that you need to pay the most attention to. I believe that the greatest form of empowerment is individual responsibility. Starting from that perspective, you should own your home, your land. If you are able to and you live in an area where you have a well, you have water rights that belong to you and should not be taken away. We are doing that. And part of the reason that we are taking away water rights is because we have folks who come from the other side of Mississippi who use Eastern water law versus Western water law. Very different. People's livelihoods, their historic family homes are based on that personal type of property right. You also have a property right to be responsible unto yourself. So let's think about the property right of a job if you are a government employee. Should that be a property right? It is. What do you think about that? The rest of us in the private sector do not think about jobs as a property right. But in our state, it is. And you need to think about the difference and what is the interplay. So let me go back to the very basic concept. Individual responsibility is the greatest form of empowerment, and that includes those things that should be yours. Your home, your personal property, your personal safety, those are yours, and we should not tread on them. You know, I just came back from the East Coast. It was very interesting. We don't think about what's happening in New Jersey or New York. Never occurred to me that individual businesses in those large towers had no property rights. They have no right to alter their property. They have no right to put a sign out. They have no right to have an antenna. I didn't know that. So be careful what you ask for.
Mr. Turner.
I tend to believe that bureaucracy's primary mission is to stay in business and continue to be a bureaucracy. And so we have talked today, this evening, about our federal government encroaching upon our state's rights. Well, what we've seen over the last 7 years is our state government encroaching on our individual rights. I am in this because I believe in freedom, and we're all here today because we believe in freedom. We've seen our state engineer's office slowly encroach upon water rights in this state, which is wrong. We have seen the federal government in Kelo, if you're familiar with that case, deal with eminent domain and try and take people's private property for public use, which is fundamentally wrong in most cases, I believe. And I also think that we need to support things like the Castle Doctrine in our state, which allow us to defend our property, defend our families, defend our rights in our own homes without being sued by an individual who we may harm or kill in the process of defending those rights. So I think to the extent that a governor can get involved in those things, a governor needs to work on making state government smaller, more efficient, less intrusive in our personal lives and in our business lives. and allowing us to get along with the business of running our own lives and our own businesses. I think it's very simple, although it seems to me that this administration has made it very complicated. I'm going to give my next 30 seconds to whoever's next.
Mr. Dominich, I'm sorry. Correct myself. Mr. Wade, you are next.
It's okay. You know, you talk about rights. Government exists to protect rights, not to create rights. And we see government at various levels creating entitlements, rights. And they're not theirs. The rights are ours. The rights are ours. Because the legitimate power of government begins and ends with us. Another thing. Government has nothing to give us except what it takes from somebody else. Westerners are often have libertarian tendencies. Live and let live. And that comes by the nature of where we live and the freedom of our space. But between eminent domain and the intrusion of government, we constantly have to be on guard everywhere, legislature, whether it's the local tax assessor coming down the street, knocking on your door. Everywhere we have to be on our guard. And I think the role of a governor of a sovereign state, as we discussed earlier, has a responsibility to take a lead in ensuring that property rights, water rights, everybody's individual rights are protected. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to talk about a right that hasn't been brought up, and I'm not sure it will be, so I want to take an opportunity to talk about it, and it's the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is what brought all of you here today. The First Amendment is what allows freedom of assembly, allows freedom of speech, allows the exchange of ideas, allows opposing ideas to foster, to spread, to share. It's fundamentally what is at the heart, at least in my conception, of what the Tea Party is trying to accomplish, is to use the First Amendment in all the various forms that it allows people to participate and to contest the status quo and to challenge the status quo. And so I'm so thankful we have the First Amendment. I'm so thankful all of you are exercising your First Amendment by being here today, which is exactly what you're doing. And when everyone reports on this, and the press is part of that too, and I know there's a lot of press here. And so when we talk about individual rights, a lot of them stem directly from that First Amendment, because that's how they become made known to the public. That's how you stand up for your other rights. That's how you stand up for your private property rights. That's how you stand up for too much regulation on your business. That's how you organize in ways that create change, that create ideas, that create whole new methods of dealing with our government. And that's one of the things I see happening in the last year, is we have had this change, sea change in Washington, and the reaction is the First Amendment in action, all over the country, in all different ways. And so that's just one fundamental, important individual right, and I urge people to exercise that right.
Mr. Wade, we go back to you.
Good question, I hope.
I'm sorry. All right. That completes the questions that we had from surveys of the Tea Party. And we'll go on. We're actually going to repeat back through our rotation. Please indulge me if I can't read your handwriting and it takes me a little while to get through the question, but we'll get the question asked. What do you think about New Mexico's current water policy, specifically the recent domestic well lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the domestic well statute, which requires the state to issue a domestic well permit to all those who apply? And I'm sorry, Mr. Domenici, you're going first.
Well, I have the New Mexico Constitution up here with me, and it recognizes water rights as a constitutional right, which is a very precise way to define a water right. And it says that beneficial use establishes a water right by constitution in New Mexico. And there is a tension between that and the statute that says people can put a domestic well in when someone may already have a constitutionally protected beneficial use of the same water. And that is really the heart of that challenge. And that is a difficult challenge. I understand it is popular, possibly, to say we should easily restore or not limit domestic wells. But that the problem with that and the tension with that is that can interfere with constitutionally protected water rights that are fundamental in our Constitution, that are recognized by our Constitution. And I know that the courts are grappling with that and the state engineer is grappling with that. I think we need to allow domestic wells where domestic wells are required for people to build houses or sustain their living situations. In other places where there are water systems available, we need to use those water systems. So I support domestic wells where they are necessary and where property can be utilized without a domestic well, which is large, large parts of New Mexico. But there are limited areas where there is already use, there's already substantial use, shortage, and there's already water available. In those circumstances, I would look towards some limitations being appropriate.
I'm going to agree with Mr. Domenici on much of what he said, but I want to add a couple of things. I happen to be a believer in sustainable agriculture. And agriculture in this state is very important. It may not be readily apparent here in the Albuquerque urban area, but it is in other parts of the state. And we have competing uses for water, as you well know. As an example, the Intel plant up in Rio Rancho consumes an enormous amount of water. I think one of the things that we need to do is get into innovative, creative ways to use water, non-potable water, in every way we can, and we'll have water reclamation projects. Some communities in our state are very good at it, much better than others. Given the fact we're a western state, there's only so much water out there, and we've got competing demands for it. Besides grappling in the courtroom, which ultimately the state engineer will have to do, there's no question about it. But besides that, we ought to be able to take a lead and encourage water reclamation, incentivize water reclamation, and look at every great idea. You know, plagiarism in the classroom is a bad idea, but where other states and other communities are doing something very well, we need to take those ideas and bring them to New Mexico, and that's something I intend to take the lead on. Thank you.
Mr. Turner.
I might get into merits here because my father is a hydrologist and water expert, and I probably should know more about this particular question than I do. He's sitting back here, and he'll probably beat me up after this. So. I tend to believe that water is a commodity, and if I have ownership of water, I ought to be able to drill a well, whether there's a water system or not. But there are many other water-related issues in New Mexico, which I think we're dealing with right now. And one of them, which I have spent quite a bit of time looking at, is the failure of our state engineer to respect regional water plans, which different parts of the state have drawn up. There's a case right now in Dabaca County, an attempt to move 7,000 acre-feet of water to Santa Fe, up some 3,000 feet, at a cost of about $150 million. Well, that's great for Santa Fe, but it's not great for places like Dabaca County or other agricultural communities which need that water for their economies and their future growth. And so I think we need a water policy in the state that recognizes and respects rural communities and metropolitan communities such as Albuquerque and Santa Fe, and ensures that there's appropriate water resources for all of those communities to sustain themselves, sustain their economies, and their livelihoods.
I have to claim some of the same things that Doug said, because my husband is a water company, and I know how complicated these issues are, that if you do not have demonstrated water for a 40-year plan or a 100-year plan, that you may actually limit development. And the last thing we want is to limit development that actually creates business. We may want to limit population. This is not a particularly easy question. So I want to go back very quickly to agriculture versus domestic use of water. And I think that's where a lot of our policy problems come into play. Because the truth is, in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, y'all don't use very much water. But in agriculture, we use a lot of water. What is the value? And I'm going to come down on the side that agriculture is very important. So, can we find ways within our water policy to make more sense, to make better use or better beneficial use of water? Let's take a look at the dairy industry, which is water intensive. One of the things that has already happened, if you're not aware, that our dairies are recycling water at least six times. At least six times for every turn, and sterilizing the water for beneficial use. Those are some of the things that we can do. In-ground irrigation makes a huge difference. And so could we create additional incentives for that type of in-ground activity? And what can we do with Elephant Butte Lake? I bring that up because 19% of all of our evaporation is the top of Elephant Butte Lake. So it's just another tidbit. So there are a lot of policies here, but I think that we have to look at water in terms of not only, first and foremost, can we provide water for our population? Is there water to drink? And then, is there water to move our state forward? It is a complicated movement, and I thank you for that, Carl.
Sometimes 2 minutes is a blessing.
Yes, it is.
All right. It took a little while to read this next one, but the tax lightning issue is still unresolved after the legislative regular sessions. As governor, how will you handle this grossly unfair, unequal tax? Do you think only executive action will work, since the legislature is obviously loath to give up their ill-gotten gains? And this person adds a little personal note that their taxes went up from $1,858 to $3,200. So, first, Mr. White.
There's nobody likes that tax assessor, I'll tell you, nobody. But especially when they come along with an inequitable, tap you on the shoulder and say, by the way, you know, the taxes are going up. I thought it was, it's unsatisfactory, to say the least, that the legislature can't resolve this. And next session, where we have a 60-day session, and the kinds of things that the governor thinks are important, I can tell you, if I'm the governor, we're going to get on top of it. We're going to get to it. It's going to be on the legislature's call, and they're going to get their arms around it, because you can't continue to have this inequity. It's and you know, the sad part about it is if you don't have the guys tapping you on the shoulder, you know, you're kind of figuring that you're okay, and but somebody else gets tagged and gets tagged bad. So you've got to level the playing field. There was a great article and a paper by Senator Mark Montano on that very recently. There are some people who, and it's a complex issue, but there are some people who can see a way through the minefield, so to speak. Bottom line, if I'm the governor, it's going to be on next year's call. We're going to get our arms around it because you just can't continue to use an old expression, run the railroad like this.
Well, I was there, and we argued. And here, there are a couple of assumptions that were made that have contributed to the problem. First off, the assumption is that our assessors today already have a true and correct assessment of your property. There is no standard across the state, and it's not true and correct. The way the law was written was you will be capped at a 3% increase after the sale if it is true and correct. But it's not true and correct, because we don't know. So here's the solution. The solution is standards across the state for our assessors, first and foremost. And by the way, tax lightning is really and truly only hitting Albuquerque. That is partly because we have more houses, more activity. It really isn't hitting the other communities yet. It creates an inequity within neighborhoods that you have to recognize. And that inequity is if you have owned your house for 20 years and Mr. St. Cyr comes in and buys a house and you started out with the same amount of taxes and now his is going to double, how's that fair? But how does that actually help your neighborhood? It doesn't. So our ability to evaluate property needs to change. There needs to be a greater standard, a standard that is used across the state. By the way, other states actually have these standards. So, for example, you can do property evaluations based on types of services that are being provided at the property, the size of the property, certain outhouses, and you would think all of this, or in-houses, whichever, all of this actually exists, but it does not. So we actually can get our arms around it. We simply have to choose to do so. But because we've pulled our tax system so much, they're very reluctant to actually hurt the county because we've pulled all of the other taxes away from the county.
I agree with both people before me. It needs to be addressed next session. Standardization is certainly part of the approach. Local tax assessment has been a political football and a political tool for generations in New Mexico. The person who knows the assessor is better off than the person who doesn't know the assessor. In all kinds of counties, and that happens all the time. So everybody wants to be friends with the assessor more than the governor even sometimes. So, but when we get to this issue, I think we need to realize next session that it is only going to get worse if we don't deal with it. It's one of these problems that just this year alone will create a huge problem for Bernalillo County by next session. And if we don't deal with it next session, it's just going to grow and grow, and it will become catastrophic for all of everyone in here that's a resident of Bernalillo County. It's going to be shouldered by everyone in Bernalillo County eventually, in some way where they decide through the courts, if necessary, or by legislation to make it fair. You have a lot more options with legislation, a lot more ways to do it, a lot more ways to spread it out or to do it more quickly, perhaps give people options. That I can see a large variety of options available legislatively. The judiciary has to apply equal protection. They are going to nail Bernalillo County, probably before next session, and probably there will be a multi-million-dollar judgment against Bernalillo County that will end up going to taxpayers. Perhaps before all that occurs, we will get into the session and deal with it. Like, it should have been dealt with this session. I know people say this session dealt with budget, but that's a critical issue.
Kind of a said, but ultimately it's fundamentally wrong. But what we probably don't realize is that New Mexico has relatively low property tax rates in the first place. If we look at Texas, that has actually very high property tax rates and very low or non-existent income or corporate income tax rates. I'm wondering if we would choose to have Texas over New Mexico, where we didn't have high taxes all around. But ultimately, I think what it comes down to here is political will. Janice and her colleagues in the legislature have been arguing about cutting taxes or raising taxes for the last 30 days at our expense and haven't gotten very far at all. And they're going to start again 2 days from now. I question whether they have the political will to get this done. And the political will, not only to deal with tax lighting, but to deal with our budget, doesn't exist. And I think we need a governor who's willing to stand up and force people to sit in a room and not leave until it's done. We haven't seen that in a long time. And I promise you that's something that I will do, not only with tax lightning, but certainly with our budget issues.
So, Mr. Turner, you go from last to first now.
Oh, no.
The question is fairly simple. Will you get rid of the EIB, the Environmental Improvement Board, and other outlaw, rogue-appointed boards of any type?
Really tough question. Yes. There are probably a half dozen or more boards, commissions, probably 2 dozen boards and commissions, blue ribbon task forces, state agencies that have been created in the last 7 years that you probably want to add to that list. You know, we used to have just a Department of Public Safety. Now we have a Department of Public Safety and a Department of Homeland Security. We used to have just the Department of Education. Now we have higher education and public education. We now have a Department of Cultural Affairs, and we have a cabinet that's probably twice as big as the cabinet that was under the previous administration. This creates more bureaucracy, and I reiterate what I said, bureaucracy is there to keep itself in business. It costs taxpayers more money. It makes our lives hell trying to comply with all the stuff that these organizations put together. And I think it goes against every concept of small and efficient government. If anyone's tried to find a parking space in Santa Fe recently, there are none. There are none. And certainly these boards and commissions do nothing except create jobs for people who I think spend most of their day working on crossword puzzles.
Mr. Domenici.
I've worked on environmental projects throughout the state of New Mexico for 25 years. I have represented all kinds of clients, cities, counties, Department of Energy facilities, down to mom and pop, who are regulated by the rules put out by the EIB. My philosophy, and I think this may differentiate me from others, is we need a fundamental change in the attitude of the majority of population in New Mexico, so they will, with the guidance of the governor, and with the understanding of the media, we'll roll back environmental legislation that is outdated, overly cautious, and extremely expensive and does not provide a benefit. That actually takes a program, a thoughtful program. The EIB is part of a statute. We have to change that statute. We have a legislature who is progressive, many of them. They're controlled by this people who believe these things are important. We need the information from groups like you all across the state to say, we have to put an end to this. And we have to roll back a whole series of laws in order to get rid of these boards and allow businesses to grow and to value our businesses instead of punishing our businesses. And this is an opportunity to do that. This election is an opportunity to start at the top, to use the media, work with the media, work with your First Amendment rights, and get this state on track where people can do business here without excessive and unrealistic and unscientific environmental regulation.
We'll start easy. Yeah. And I say that the assumptions that have gone along with the actions of the EIB, and in some cases the New Mexico Environment Department, I find are extremely frightening. And the assumption that you may not always hear is that we are going to change many of our regulations in the way that we are approaching business or activities in the name of creating green jobs. Now, I want to remind you, the government does not create jobs. You do. And to actually have a transfer of wealth from what we consider New Mexico's natural resource-based jobs to a new economy, I think it's folly, because the free market actually takes care of this if you simply get out of the way. So, can we do away with the EIB? You know, the rules that were applied by an executive order that actually brought in California standards to the state of New Mexico, I find to be insulting, and why we did that, I still do not understand. So we may not be able to remove all of them, but there are certain things that moratoriums can be placed on them until we can get a handle on it. I believe some of the actions of the AIB is one of them. Some of the issues with the New Mexico Environment Department and their use of regulatory enforcement in many cases are absolutely detrimental to business, but do nothing to enhance the safety and welfare of our citizens, which is its only role. We're supposed to do that. And so let me just throw in the pit roll while we're talking about it. I know we all want to say, oh my goodness, we're going to overturn it. Well, we probably can't, but we can issue a moratorium almost immediately so we can go back and move on.
Mr. Webb,
we got some contracts. She can't. I will. Amendment 50 of the pit rule is going in the first 48 hours that I'm the governor. If we can't, while we're waiting to study things to death and while we're trying to get the legislature to agree, I'm going to take out my pen. And I'm going to start line item vetoing funding for some of these useless boards, commissions, and other things that are on our backs, and we're going to shut them down. I don't think I can break Gary Johnson's record of vetoes. I was told he had 831. Legislature and round up some moderate Democrats, the Republican caucus, and get some things done. And yeah, we can work on getting this done legislatively, but we're not going to wait on that. That's the point. We're not going to wait. We're going to get government off of people's backs, because that's the single most important thing we can do to jumpstart our economy. And we need to do that. We can do that. And we will do that. There are more useless boards, commissions, and appendages of government in Santa Fe than the law allows. Only, I guess, we created them over the years. So, the object of this next administration is to reset government, and with it, eliminate these unnecessary rules, regulations, and appendages of government so that we get down as part of the budget process, too. The more we get rid of, the less we have to spend money on. The bureaucracy needs to be fed. It continually has to be fed. So we've got to put the bureaucracy on the diet. Thank you.
The next question will go first to Ms. Arnold Jones, and Mr. Turner, Mr. Way, and Mr. Domenici. What is your position on illegal immigration and amnesty for illegals?
Okay. That's a good one. I'm not for illegal immigration. I'm for legal immigration. And the fact that we have not change the way that our borders operate, that we have not secured our borders, is wrong, it's dangerous, and as governor, it will stop. And I don't care what the rest of the nation is going to do. At this point, we have to secure our own borders. What is coming across our borders in both directions should scare the snot out of you. We are, and when I tell you that, we are having, drugs are coming over our borders, an economy is coming over our borders that you are not even recognizing, and yet it's coming up to Albuquerque, and it is creating a crime problem. Going in the reverse direction, we've had nuclear weapons from our nation go the other way. What are we thinking? What are we waiting for? We have the technology. We have the people in place. The governor has a right to secure this border. Now let me just tell you about illegal aliens and amnesty. You know, we all have friends that live in Mexico in particular. We have friends from other nations. And you know what? The one thing I want, the one thing this nation was built on is immigrants. It makes us stronger. But to suspend the rules for one and make a special rule for another, it's not right. It is not right.
I believe in legal immigration also, and I also believe, you know, in the power of immigrants in this country. I think most of us probably can trace our lineage back to immigrants at one point or another. But certainly, the challenge that we have in New Mexico with illegal immigration is huge. We currently have, I think, 78 of our National Guardsmen, New Mexico National Guardsmen, on the border, trying to do the job of the federal government, which is not actually enforcing its current rules. We have a state government that's providing driver's licenses to people who are here illegally, which I think is wrong, and that has to be changed. But certainly the criminal component is very important and very personal to me. A number of years ago, someone broke into my car in front of my house, and I chased him down, and I caught him in the road, and I held him down in the street until the police arrived. And the police arrived, and they said, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to press charges? And I said, yes. And they said, well, there's probably no point, because he will be turned over to the INS, he will be shipped back to Mexico, and he'll probably be back in your neighborhood the next week. We have to do something to stop that problem. But I will also say that we have had successful programs in New Mexico in the past that have brought guest workers to New Mexico to work in the agricultural industry. We've taxed them. They've received benefits from the organizations which have hired them. It's helped our economy. The dairy industry is looking for this, and certainly a lot of the other components of our agriculture industry. So we have to find a solution, but it has to make sense, and it has to be, as Janice said, consistent across the board.
Yeah, I think we're all on the same page on this one. We need a border so tight you know when an ant crosses it. And I gotta tell you, it's not unimportant. And I realize that 90% of the people seeing you cross the border are here just to do harmless things. But it's the other percentage that concerns me. But the fact is, you don't cross the border illegally. And we have an obligation. We take an oath. Whichever one of us is governor is going to take an oath at office. You fulfill your oath of office, and you carry out your duties. And crossing the border is illegal. We have a sanctuary policy currently issued by this administration on the state police, similar to that which is in Albuquerque. I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be removed in the first 24 hours under governor. That's great. Border governor has an obligation. The immigration policy is set, the federal government set, Congress, we all know that. The last time we tried it, we failed, 1987. Government purportedly did immigration reform. And they put the doggone law back up on the shelf and went back to business as usual, and that's why we got what we got, and we don't trust the government anymore. So we've got to do a much better job. And I think as a border state governor, knowing the problems, since we do have an international border, a governor has an obligation to help influence that policy. I can tell you, I agree with Doug. I've often thought that once we've got a secure border, you've got biometric identification capabilities, I think a guest worker program is important. But the federal government's got to do it. But I'm in favor of that. Thank you.
The national delegation from New Mexico, along with the president, has not elevated immigration to a level where they will deal with a crisis that we are bearing the burden of. And as governor, what is going to end up happening, in my prediction, we are going to end up enforcing the state immigration practice. And we're going to have to do that. It won't be pleasant. There will be many hardship cases. There will be many heartbreaking cases. But unless we do that, and by that I mean when people are here illegally and are deported, even though they have families, even though they have ties, when they are deported by our state police, when the sanctuary policy is gone, as I would agree with Alan Way, then that issue will start receiving more attention. And we do not have enough example of our senators and our congressmen pushing that issue that our governor can wait. So we are going to end up doing immigration policy at the state level, even though it's a federal issue. And I'm prepared to do that because it will force our delegation to make it a federal issue. It will force them to raise it to that level, to get the fence built that is funded and paid for and ready to be built, and it will get the Congress to deal with these complicated issues. But they won't do it when states have sanctuary policies, when basically the status quo is allowed by state governors, and they don't force Congress to take action. We cannot allow that to continue, then the problem is worse, and it's harder to fix. It's another one of those, you were pushing it off to someone else, and it will be harder. I won't do that.
I'm going to tax you just a little bit in that I've gotten a follow-up, and I'd like to give each of you 1 minute instead of two, because it is a follow-up question, to give your opinion on this. And Mr. Domenici, you're first in the rotation. We just talked about illegal immigration. What do we do about the illegals that are here now?
Well, that's, I think I almost answered that already, but we begin to enforce federal immigration law as a state. That's what we do. We arrest illegals through our state police, our state department of public safety, the state agencies that are controlled by the state. And we take those people to the border if we have to. We take them to INS if we have to. But we do not say, because there's no federal policy, we cannot do that for another year. So I don't have much to follow up on that, actually. That's how I want to proceed, is to enforce the immigration laws. If we have to pass state laws to do that, we would pass them. And then, eventually, Congress will get the message, or they won't, and we'll end up back where we were with the federalist idea, where states are going to do immigration. It's not a good idea, but that's the
It's a difficult one, we all know. The estimates vary, but they say we've got anywhere from 13 to 15 million people in this country scattered all over the United States now. It's not just border states. I believe in enforcing the laws. Pure and simple. We don't ignore the law. We enforce the law. When you start enforcing the law, as Pete said, you know, pretty soon the population, the illegal population starts attriting itself. They, one of two things happen, logically. They're either apprehended, and I don't suggest, by the way, that we devote resources to going out deliberately to go look for these people. I'm talking about the normal course of law enforcement when they come across people, unless they're breaking a crime, of course. I mean, breaking the law and be doing a criminal offense. But you start enforcing the law, the attrition will occur on the number of illegals here. There's going to have to be a resolution and some compassion shown for some of the people over a period of time, but that's a federal issue, and we'll have our voice heard. Thank you.
Mr. Turner.
I agree that we have to force existing laws. What I worry about in such an extreme perspective is that we become a police state, which is certainly not something we want to be. If people are breaking laws and they are here illegal, then we need to be legally, then we need to enforce the laws and get them back to where they ought to be. But I think it is a very, very tough issue. And the last thing you want to see are groups of police roving around the neighborhood, knocking on doors and hauling people out of their homes. No, I'm not disagreeing. I mean, I think that's a tough issue, and I think it's something that our federal government needs to deal with. I don't see the state coming up with a policy, because the last thing we need is every border state having its own policy on how to deal with immigrants. We need a national policy, and we need to work with our members of Congress to come up with a policy that works and that is humane.
You know, enforcing your laws is absolutely a terrific place to start, and I think we should do that. But this is a bigger issue. And so let's go back and ask why people are coming across our borders to work in our state illegally. Why is that happening? And it's because they're just like you and me. They want a better way of life. So rather than sit here and think about whether or not we're going to just throw them in the pokey and they'll come back and forth several times, I would like to propose an idea. And I'm still fleshing this out a little bit. But could we, as a state, enforce a policy that if you are illegal and you want to work in our state, that you may do so for a year, but you and the company you work for will pay double taxes on the right to do that? Because we have an incentive right now for people to cross our border. Can we change that? And after a year, the next step is you need to become a citizen. I don't know that that's the answer, but I know that if we just stand here and wring our hands and say, we have no answers, then we will have no answers. So let's try something new.
The next one goes to Mr. Wade, then Ms. Arnold-Jones, Mr. Domenici, and Mr. Turner. It will take courage to face down the Democratic legislature. Give us an example of something courageous that you've done.
Well, let me tell you. I'm not in the business in parts of my life of running around tooting my own horn and trying to, do that. So I'm not going to do that. But what I am going to do is tell you that I've got the courage to stand down the New Mexico legislature if I have to. I do have that courage. There's nobody in Senate that I'm afraid of. If anything, Speaker Ruhlman ought to be afraid of me. So I look forward to the challenge, if I'm given that challenge. On the other hand, I'll extend my hand to everybody. Every Democrat will get my hand. I know some of them are going to bite it, but the fact of the matter is I'm going to extend it. And I think it's a good place to start, because we need civility, but we will be, we'll do what we have to do. We get the job done. Thank you.
Mrs. Arnold-Jones.
And it's not about courage. It's just simply about standing up and doing the right thing. So, a couple of examples. I took a webcam to the legislature. The speaker was ticked. I didn't do that to be mean or ugly, but the things that he was doing to you just made my skin crawl. And unless you could see and you could hold the legislature accountable, it wasn't going to change. And he was really angry. And the really interesting thing is while I happen to be a Republican, most of my colleagues are Democrats. We are heavily outnumbered. And by any measure, the issue of transparency should be a Democratic issue. They would love to stand up and say, please do that. Their leadership said no. But I want to tell you about what it's like to stand against the Speaker when he is breaking the Constitution. And you stand there all by yourself. And you argue. And he says, we got the votes. You still stand there.
I think I said before, I've worked representing clients for 25 years against, virtually all of that work is against the state of New Mexico. Yes, it is. Against the state of New Mexico to get mines operating, to get the WIC facility operating, to get cities out from under their restrictions. And during all those 25 years, the legislature has been controlled just like it is now by Democrats. And during all those 25 years, my name has been Pete Domenici Jr. And I go to Santa Fe and I fight the state of New Mexico that is our bureaucrats, virtually all Democrats, that know the legislators, they are funded by the legislators, they work with the legislators, and I've made a living for myself in this state, succeeding, have successful projects all over this state, and then on top of that, I decided to run for governor.
I'm not sure anyone can compete with Alan on the courage meter. But, I actually sued the governor. I'm not sure anyone has done that. I served for 8 years as chairman of the Judicial Standards Commission for Gary Johnson, and when Richardson became governor, he violated the Constitution and demanded that everyone who had been appointed by Johnson immediately leave office. And I went and sat down with him, and I said, Governor, violated the Constitution. He said, I don't care, I'm the governor. And I said, fine, then I'm suing you right now in the Supreme Court. And I walked over and sued him in the Supreme Court. Of course, I lost. But honestly, I think probably the most courageous thing that I've done is gotten married to my wife, Mala, here. Had two children. We're building a new house, and I'm running for governor. With respect to the Democrats in the legislature, I think what we really need here is we need a governor who's willing to go out and campaign for Republicans in legislative seats and even campaign for conservative, business-minded Democrats around the state. We haven't had that for a while, and I'm prepared to do that.
Two more questions. We should be doing 2 minutes here. Mr. Turner, you're first again, then Mr. Domenici, Ms. Arnold Jones, and Mr. Wade. This is a very fairly specific question. What do you plan to do about the unfunded pension and benefits liabilities?
Good question. So our unfunded pension and benefit liability, if anyone wants to take a guess, over the long term is now unfunded to the tune of $22 billion. $22 billion. I think what you have to do is you have to change the state pension plan from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. And I think that there is going to be outcry from state employees who will see that their pensions are just as much at risk as all of our pensions. I know that my 401k took a digger last year and is worth probably half what it was. And I don't have a defined benefit plan. That doesn't happen with state employees. State employees will get whatever we promise them today in perpetuity if we continue with the plan that we have. So that has got to change. I think there has to be increased contributions into that fund from state employees. And I also think we need to start to stop investing with the kinds of funds that we've been investing in. You know, under our previous administration, not 1 cent was paid in third-party placement fees. Under this administration, we've paid, $22, $30, $50 million. Who knows how much we've spent? And these funds themselves have gone down the toilet. We've lost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in these funds. We need to change the way we invest our money, and we demand we need to change the structure of the Senate.
Some of the things Doug said, the investment practices, excuse me, have been horrible for this administration. As we're seeing more and more, the temptation and then the actual corruption and illegal activity with these large investment funds is unconscionable for the state. So we do need to revamp that, make that a professional process, and use professionals to do that. Not political appointees, and we need to get the fee structure out of that. But that really won't solve the majority of the problem. The problem is the unfunded nature of this. And I think, in order to be fair, when you have these large unfunded liabilities, but they're promises to people out there that are sitting at home or have their last year to work or whatever, you have to phase those in. I've seen too many arbitrary actions by the state against businesses where they don't phase things in, and all of a sudden business has a whole new regime to deal with. And I don't want to treat our employees the same way. And I think a lot of those situations can be much better served by prospectively dealing with them and spending the time to phase those changes in so people know what's coming and people have time to prepare for them. So I would propose we have to get that on the agenda. We have to start phasing it in quickly. And so people that are starting jobs and that are currently employed and are building pension reserves that they're relying on know that they have there are changes that they're facing through the rest of their career or if they're starting for their entire career. But for people that have already done their service, I think we need to honor our obligations.
Are there very many people in here getting a military retirement? Which you have. You know, I have to agree with Pete Domenici that we've made a promise in our pensions. And you have to honor that promise. And it is I would fight just as hard if the military retirements were altered. So, are we helpless? We are not. So, proactively, we need to raise the requirements. We still have 20 and 25-year pension plans. Most businesses require 35 years of service today. So that's one of the first things that we can do. The second thing we can do as a legislature, in particular, we can start making the contributions that we should have started making 8 years ago. I sat on the commission to actually fund the ERB to bring it to solvency. I saw the plan, and my colleagues chose the worst of it, and then we didn't fund it. How can you look at your citizens in the face knowing that that actually happened? So I think Doug Turner is also right. We have to go from defined benefit to defined contribution. But again, you need to start making those changes more slowly. But as people come into the system, that's when you need to make those changes, and we need to start now with a comprehensive plan. But we have an obligation. We need to meet it.
This problem for the state of New Mexico is just as severe as Social Security is for us nationally. And the magnitude of the unfunded liability is staggering. I don't think there's any question that we're going to be compelled by legal precedent that people who are in the program today are going to be grandfathered, so to speak. In other words, if they entered the program, they're going to be entitled to the retirements based upon the retirement program as it is today. Therefore, we're going to have to pay our way out of that liability, but there's no question that we have to implement the necessary changes such as are outlined. There's only so many, and the ones that have been discussed all up here already are valid, good, defined contribution versus defined benefit. Transparency and competency in investment management. Everybody that's been in, seems to have been involved in the current investment of our funds seems to skip town and go to France and taking our money with them. So clearly, we've got to do some due diligence there. Extending out, as Mr. Jones said, the mandatory retirement, instead of being at 20 years, it needs to be longer than that. I mean, they created a good deal for themselves. The problem is, we're paying for it. And fair is fair, so we'll grandfather the ones there now, but we got to change it, because we're going to go broke if we don't.
Actually, nobody's used that speaking out of turn, so...
My lifeline? I'd just like to point out, New Mexico has one of the most generous, health and retirement benefit packages in the country. And an interesting thing to keep in mind is that we also have one of the fattest governments. I mean, for every 100 private sector employees in the state, 24 of them are state and local government. So, you know, we are giving our state employees huge benefit packages, huge retirement packages, and we expect very little of them. So,
20. All right, this next question will go to Mrs. Arnold Jones, and Mr. Turner, Mr. Way, and Mr. Domenici. It's a two-part question. I'll try and put it together. Very direct. Should the failed railroader program be discontinued, and should other state failed programs be ended, or what other state failed programs should be ended?
I'm not a fan of the railroader. The reason I am not a fan is it was very clear from the beginning how much it was going to cost us. Having sat on the floor while they argued that we would not need to widen I-25 because we were going to put the rail runner in. By the way, have y'all seen that construction? I just thought I'd check on that. And so we were supposed to be spending slightly under $400 million. We're close to $1 billion. And the contract, you know, the governor and the AG needs to pay attention to the contract. It is bleeding us dry. It actually, in my opinion, steps on the authority of the appropriating responsibility of the legislature, because the contract actually tells us how much money we have to put in for safety upgrades. Reading the details is really important. So, do I think we have a way out? You know, I will tell you what, there are a lot of people who really, really love this rail runner, but it's $50 million a year. That's what it's costing us. Could we do better by actually using small buses and provide greater service throughout our state? You know, we're a huge state, and the one thing that we do need is connectivity. And so all we have connected is Belen to Santa Fe. Another way to actually solve this problem, because what they're going to argue to you is, well, I have my jobs in Santa Fe at the Department of Transportation or at Tax and Revenue. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know what? We can move those departments. I'm looking at the numbers. I run the numbers all the time. I just don't know how we can come out of this. But here's the really bad news. If we sell it today, we will not get a nickel on the dollar. That's your asset, and that just kills me.
I actually think it would be more cost effective to put people in cabs. And I also think that if we tried to sell it, we wouldn't find anyone who would buy it because it costs so much money to run. But you know what? It's a sunk cost. We're not going to undo it. What we can do is put to bed any discussion of extending it to Las Cruces, and there are those conversations. We can put to bed any discussion of extending it to Taos. And as Pete said earlier, we need to look for ways to decrease the amount of money that we're bleeding on this project. But it's sunk, and I don't think we're going to be able to undo it. Just as a note, I don't know of a public transportation in the world that actually makes money, system in the world that makes money. So if we can just make this one lose less money, it might be a little more palatable. We've got the spaceport. Anyone know how much money that Richard Branson has put into the spaceport? Zero. Not $1. And yet we're building a 100,000-foot terminal. We've just finished we're in the process of finishing a 10,000-foot runway. We're not going to be able to undo that one either. So my hope is for things like the spaceport that we can make some money with commercial applications, satellite launches, things like that, but that's going to take a long time. I mean, the bottom line is this administration has robbed every possible fund it could find. And it recently robbed an Environment Department fund to put another $11 million into the rail runner. We need an administration that's prepared to cut everything that we possibly can. But again, these things are sunk costs, and we're not going to be able to undo it. It probably cost us more to dig up the spaceport than it cost us to put it in. So, tough situation.
Business arrangements are something I'm reasonably familiar with, and these kind of things are, in effect, small businesses, if you will, that the state has formed, the spaceport. I like the fact that Richard, I've been using his name and out as I've talked to people. The governor got into that deal because it sounded good, looked good. But the fact is that the deal's not good for New Mexico. The rail runner gets 13% of its operating cost based on revenues. That's totally disproportionate. That doesn't even come close to the East Coast subsidies that we find where you have rail going up and down the East Coast. And at least there's some parity. Here, there's no parity. The movie industry is another one that's often talked about. Frankly, this administration has kept a lot of things in the dark. The next governor is going to have to examine the fine print on all these business deals. As far as I'm concerned, they ought to return to the taxpayer, just like return to an investor, an equitable return on that investment. Whether it's the rail runner, whether it's the spaceport, whether it's the movie industry, as far as I'm concerned, the state of New Mexico has an agreement to do anything. It's going to be equitable to the taxpayer.
Mr. Domenech.
Thank you. I've spoken on sort of on the business side of the rail runner. The one of the more difficult and really more critical parts of the rail runner is the political side of it. The rail runner was constructed so our governor could elevate himself to a level where he could run for president. Political mistake and a political opportunity, frankly, taken by the governor, seconded by the lieutenant governor, to allow him to run and to burden us at a tune of now $50 million a year, and we've actually put it into not just state, but we've localized all those burdens, all of that so we could rush to judgments to build a what is a beautiful rail runner. Would be great in a tourist area or somewhere where you could actually afford it or on the East Coast. But it was done for the wrong purpose, for the wrong reason, and we're going to have to unwind it and salvage it the best we can. The spaceport had a similar motive behind it. And these projects with these improper personal motives of the governor and lieutenant governor are going to haunt us, and they're going to chase us. And like Alan says, we're going to have to dig them out. Another example is the governor decided to get in the venture capital business and set up a venture capital fund and then set up a group that would give money to essentially compete with venture capitalists with no expertise. There's been no accounting of that. My understanding is that it has been a horrible failure. We have virtually no jobs, no businesses, no return on a multi-year, it's now in the hundreds of millions of dollars investment for that venture capital exercise. Thank you.
Ms. Arnold-Jones is going to make her out of turn.
I'm going to take a lifeline. I want to offer a different perspective on the spaceport. You know, we do some really terrible things sometimes, but sometimes, in spite of you, the private market, free enterprise, comes to the rescue. And so the spaceport, I promise you, we'll never see a nickel from Richard Branson, never. We don't have a contract, we have an MOU. my toilet paper is worth more. But what we do have is an emerging industry that is looking at suborbital satellites. And they have no place to launch. They're going to Anawita right this minute. Private industry can do this. It is an opportunity that is unique to New Mexico. And I hope that we are smart enough to deal with the debt that we've created, but also be open to the opportunity, because it would be a dramatic change for our state. The Office of Operational and Responsive Space Command at Kirtland Air Force Base actually needs this capability today, right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're just about out of time. I wanted to do one other thing just to relax the evening a little bit. I wanted to ask one more question. It's very simple, probably 10 seconds or less. Mr. Domenici first, Mr. Way second, Mr. Turner third, and Ms. Arnold Jones fourth. Red or green?
Bravo.
I know it's controversial, but I'll go with red. Mr. White?
I'm a red guy, too.
Mr. Turner?
I'm a green guy. It's hotter.
And Ms. Arnold Jones.
That green stuff is only hotter if you don't get Jemima chili. I like red.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your questions. I know there were more, but in the interest of time, we're gonna move on. And at this point, we're going to have 90 seconds for each of the candidates to do a summation. Again, we pulled out the random generator. We got a new order. First up will be Mr. Wade, then Mr. Domenici, Ms. Arnold Jones, and then Mr. Turner. So, 90 seconds, Mr. Wade.
What's my vision for New Mexico above the governor? After 8 years, a flourishing economy, a higher standard of living, improved education, lower taxes, and increased public safety. Not an impossible dream, so I'll tell you the story. I went 41 years ago, almost to the day, and I was on an infantry operation in Vietnam. And we were walking, and a Marine about 10 yards away from me stepped on a mine, blew him up in the air, he landed. Both his legs below his knees were blown off. He didn't know it. An explosion had cauterized him, so he wasn't bleeding. There were two bones sticking out. Kind of a gruesome sight. He hadn't seen it yet. Called in the medevac helicopter. Took about 10 minutes. Helicopter lands. By that point, troops put him on a poncho. He didn't have litters out there. He used ponchos. They started dragging him to this helicopter. And he saw his legs. There was a song in the 1960s called by Jack Jones, and it was The Impossible Dream. And this young man started singing The Impossible Dream. To this day, I see that. And to this day, that Marine, whose name I've long since forgotten, has inspired me to get up and take on things that are impossible. I can tell you, this is going to be a tough job, but not impossible. If I'm your governor, I'm going to let you down.
Mr. Domenici.
I have enjoyed the Tea Party growth throughout the country and throughout the state. This is the second sponsored event that we've been to. What my vision, and I have a vision too, and at the end of the road, it looks very similar to Alan Way's. But the way to get there, and I have a way I think will get us there, and it is using forums like this, using education, using our First Amendment rights, and actually training people, our citizens, our friends, our neighbors, our children, that the fundamental constitutional protections that we have cannot be overcome by government, that the role of government is limited, and that business is positive, working is positive, producing our natural resources is positive, and in order to do that, we need a mindset change from the grassroots, and that's why I'm so encouraged to see grassroots tea parties all over the state, and I hope they grow, and I hope they spread, and I hope they create a sea change where all these resources and assets that we have that we are holding back on, we can take advantage of, because the media will come behind us, the common person will understand the benefits and not be scared and fear-mongering, and propaganda will come to an end. Thank you.
I just want to thank the Albuquerque Tea Party. You've done a wonderful job tonight, and thank you all for participating. You know, I'm running for governor because we have all grown tired of our state being known for graft, corruption, and poor service. It is time for New Mexico to be known for the ethical choices we make and the limited regulatory climate that enables free market enterprise. I am running for governor to transform the state government into a public trust. Government is meant to be the servant of the people, not a master that steadily erodes our individual liberties. For the past 7 years, we have had unbridled spending, an absentee governor, and numerously highly paid political appointees in positions of authority and power that were often ineffective, incompetent, or both. I'm going to change that. I'm running for governor to bring to New Mexico a new and smarter economy. Using free markets, I will help connect our vast natural, human, and technical resources and transform our state into one that excels, not one that fails. When I'm your governor, I will provide principled leadership that advocates for individual liberty, economic opportunity, and prosperity for all New Mexicans. I ask for your vote in June and in November. Thank you so much.
Mr. Turner.
You mentioned when we started, we were all applying for the job as governor, and I'll tell you, this is the most difficult job interview I've ever had. This is an amazing year, and it's going to be an incredible year for Republicans in this state, especially for people who are sick and tired of what's going on. You've seen it all around the state, certainly with Tea Parties, but really with Democrats, with independents, with just people who have had enough. And I'm in this race precisely for that reason, but more important, I'm in this race because I think there are issues that we can succeed upon, in achieving in 2010. You know, I got involved in this campaign for a number of reasons, but one of them was because of public education. I don't think we've talked about it at all. I'm a strong advocate of homeschooling and support for homeschoolers. I'm a strong advocate for more support for charter schools. I'm a strong advocate for more vocational training in public schools. I also believe that if we don't have a good public education system in this state, everything else is for nothing. We can't have economic development. We can't have a prosperous economy. I'll say one last thing. Republicans tend to elect outsiders in this state to become governor. We've done it with Gary Johnson. We did it with Dave Cargo, who took the North, a part of the state that we always forget. And we did it with the economics professor in Gary Carruthers. I promise you, when I am elected as the nominee in June, Diane Dennisch will be, the Democratic Party will be looking for a new candidate because they will not be able to compete with an honest man. So thank you for coming.